to see you.
No, I will.
There's nothing to kneel on there.
Oh, I'm fine.
Well, we know that. We know that, Francie. You're our standard of what we're aiming for. There, you got a cushion. A legal cushion. We're actually, secretly, we go home, we practice Francine. We all say 100,000, Om Francine, And I've done 300,000, so I'm very close. I'm going for a million. Everybody got all the paper?
No.
These intros? Do you want to pass one to Francine first? Okay. We're not going to get past the intro, so if you don't have a copy of the other one and there are no more copies, we'll get them later. Okay, this is going to be a series of ongoing classes. This is going to take us right until the spring. So this is going to be an ongoing study of the actual teaching that is Buddhism, because I think very few people really understand what Buddhism is on about. A lot of people love the techniques. A lot of people love the skill of the meditations. A lot of people love the idea. But very few people know what the idea really is. And probably when you begin to understand what Buddhism is, you're not going to like it either. Because it is the philosophy of deconstruction. It is the philosophy of deconstruction. So there are very, very many people who might start off thinking that they could be a Buddhist. And a whole lot of them by the end will say they could use some Buddhist teaching. Which is just fine. Whatever there is in Buddhism that is useful, please use it. No, you're not, it is absolutely not essential to become a Buddhist, but I'm delighted to be able to teach actually what Buddhism actually is. It's a great joy for me. So, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Now, first of all, I got this letter. Mailed on September 11th from the Novayana Society saying that they're interested formally in requesting an exploration and discussion on the middle-length discourse. Middle-length discourse. This costs $75. If you decide you like these classes, I recommend the $75. This is a wonderful book. What's nice is that we're going to Xerox a certain amount of it, so you get a chance to look at it and decide, and we'll do some study. Because $75 is $75, and you might not want to do that. This is a beautiful book, beautiful translation.
Where do you get the book?
I think Amazon.com has it, do they?
Amazon.
Yeah.
Snow Lion.
Snow Lion
has it?
Yeah. Okay.
Snow Lion has it, yeah.
Sure,
that's very beautiful. So I've been asked to, and thank you for the formal invitation. I really appreciate that. It's really nice to know you want something, you know. You know that I'll just tell bad jokes and go on and on. But if you actually ask me... Yeah, well, I probably will. But if you ask me to teach something, that's really wonderful. You also asked for a Pali alphabet, the Western alphabet, and the five elements. So we're going to touch on the first and third of those a little bit. Because how many of you are not familiar at all with any kind of Buddhism? Great. There are two basic schools, two basic divisions. One's called the Southern School, and one's called the Northern School. The Northern School is this and that. Those kind of deity pictures, that one there. Those ones that are framed there. The Southern School is a stupa. This is called a stupa because it's arranged like the five elements in an orderly way. So it represents a mind that is not caught in neuroses. A mind that is not caught in neuroses uses the five elements in a harmonious and joyous way for the liberation of all beings. So it is the same as the mind of awakening. So that stupa represents the mind of awakening. The figure of the Buddha represents the body, how to manifest in the world as awakening. And if it were a true shrine, either Southern School or Northern School, it would also have a text on it or a mantra somewhere to represent the teaching and the energy of awakening, the speech quality of awakening also. Those three things are the basic three refuges in Buddhism. And they are not actually a person. There is not actually a figure that represents that. In fact, in the earliest Buddhism, for the first 200 or 300 years, there were no statues. There were mirrors, an empty mirror to represent the mind that can be the shape of whatever is present, and a footprint representing a way, a movement, a path. Those were the earliest representations that made. And then over time, especially with the Greek influence in Buddhism, Buddhist Greek connection, and you know how great the Greeks were at statues. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the first Buddha Rupas actually start with the Greek interaction with Buddhist philosophy. That's where they first began to be made. And then by the time they come to the Northern schools, where there is much less emphasis on using the intelligence to know what is not path. Do you understand that? What is not path? This is not path. This is not path. Which is basically what the Northern School does. This is not path. This is not path. This is not path. This is not path. And in order to balance that, they do, so that it doesn't get too dry, they do practices of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, jhana practice, that is, practice of absorption into blissful states, to keep the mind soft and malleable, while at the same time keeping the intelligence sharp by saying, oh, this is too limited, this is not totality mind, no, this is not totality mind, no, this is not. So as you can imagine, in the southern schools, there's a lot of emphasis placed on sitting in one place and getting away from villages and not being involved a lot with society. And yet there is a great dependence on society, because it is society that feeds the community of ordained people. So people were told to live near villages but not spend too much time there. So the people who ordained people and the people who worked in villages would come to people who were ordained when they were caught in problems and ask for advice, which was freely given. Yeah. Also, if someone was homeless or was crazy or was an orphan, they would go and live in a monastery where they would eat and be taken care of. So it was like a social system, in a way. You could also learn how to read and write at monasteries. areas that didn't have schools. So there was a kind of an interaction. But when monks went on retreat, monks and nuns to a lesser degree in the early days, they would go into the forest and they would really do this, not this, not this, so that the kind of shrine of a northern school is very simple, very straightforward. Three things, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, representing the body of awakening, the speech of awakening, and the mind of awakening. And that's all she wrote. Then when you get to the northern schools, you have Buddhism arising in Tibet, mostly Tibet. We're talking about also the Mahayana schools of India and China and so forth. When you get to the northern schools, you get a whole time where Buddhism went from India to China via a historical figure known as Bodhidharma. And as Bodhidharma went to China and taught transmission mind Buddhism, particularly, which is very simple, which eventually became Zen, Chan and Zen teaching when it went to Japan, also that teaching spread back around into Tibet. This is before the 8th century, our calendar times. And so a lot of the teaching that spread back around into Tibet was very involved also with the shamanistic teaching of people there. And there is enough evidence to support that large parts of Buddhism that were not the Theravadan school of not this, not this, also used the shamanistic teaching and the tantric teachings very heavily as well. And then there was a king for about 6 or 8 years in Tibet around the 8th century who he was a king for a very short period of time, I think 6 or 8 years. And he was not happy with a lot of the ideas of Buddhism. He was more interested in dictatorship and returning the old way. So he almost totally destroyed any sign of Buddhism in Tibet in the 6 or 8 years that he was a ruler. He tore down monasteries, killed everyone. He did a really efficient job. And only in some of the further reaches where there was the influence of Buddhism from China that came around from Bodhidharma, only in the furthest reaches of Tibet did there remain a school of Buddhism, which is called the Nyingma school. Okay, that's the Nyingma school. Maybe some of you have heard of Dzogchen teaching. That's Nyingma, equivalent to Mahamudra, which is Kagyu, which is equivalent to Zen. Okay, mind-only school. They're equivalent.
Is that triggered by the Chinese influence?
No. Yeah, the Nyingma school has a lot of its roots both in India and in China. Mm. So when the teaching came from China, before this king, whose name I unfortunately have forgotten, you can fire me later. People also had sent or went to India to study and brought it back. So the Nyingma school was a real mixture of Chinese influence through Bodhidharma going to it from India to China, and Indian, and also the Obon religion. So it was a mixture of all of them, really. After this particular king, then came people like Atisha and Nagarjuna came. Nagarjuna was in India before that. What Nagarjuna did, this is some time after the time of the Buddha, and he isn't happy with what he hears is Buddhism, because he feels like the real teaching is getting lost in philosophy. And if you've read enough of the Indian tradition of Buddhism, you can see exactly what he's talking about. I mean, laundry lists and nitpicking. You know, it makes English philosophers like Hume look like they are in a kindergarten or something. It's really incredible how nitpicking and specific they get. And so Nagarjuna traced back and, in fact, rediscovered the whole teaching of Shunya. And it is on the basis of Nagarjuna's teaching, which then later became what was brought to Tibet after this king, that the northern schools really developed. So you get these kinds of deities which represent this one in particular, Green Tara. I have another picture of her here, which I'm going to pass around. Green Tara represents the basic state of mind only, and is exactly the same as that ah syllable inside that white syllable inside the blue with the rainbow light coming out and then the white rays coming out. There is this center point within your being, within all being, without all being, that you cannot really define, because any definition is still involved in naming. So there is this basic original mind, which Tara represents. Now there are different qualities of understanding original mind. Tara is the one who gives birth to the Buddha, gives birth to that in you. It is from this quality of consciousness in your being that which understands truth is born. And it's born continuously. Every time you have an insight, that is like an aspect of Buddha being born in you. So that's what this represents. And she, or the birthing of that, has four ways that it acts. And these four ways are called, where is it? Pacifying at the bottom. I'm going to pass this around. I'm just going to point this out. Which is water element. Becoming peaceful. Prospering, which is earth element. Extending, becoming richer. Seducing, which is fire element. That great desire without object, that desire push to union with totality. And air, which is wrathful, because air is never still. Everything is always ended in air. Everything is always cut off with air. Okay. Just believe me for the moment. I'll get back to it. I love his questions. He has such good questions. So you can see here, and in that awe picture, the blue in the center is the great awe sound, which is the center of all being. And from that, there is a vibration, energy, to manifest called the continuum consciousness in Buddhism. The continuum consciousness, okay? Which manifests through four vibrations. So arising in space, the four elements. And, okay, so you can look at that. So, I'm going to take a little longer with this than Was there a piece of paper in here? Don't tell me I forgot one piece of paper. Isn't that incredible? Okay, I'll be right back. I forgot one piece of paper. You might as well turn that off. I'm almost finished all the dry history. This is from Sal Tremaglione's book, Women of Wisdom, and it's page 27. I recommend the book highly. And this is a description that I would like you to sort of maybe close your eyes or whatever and pay attention. Right now, feel the space that's around you. The first quality of the five elements that you look at is called the Buddha family. It's associated with the element of space. When it's arising in a neurotic state, there is a sense of thickness and dullness. Or maybe a spaced out feeling, like you can't quite connect. See how your consciousness feels. There's a tendency to want to be lulled to sleep. When anything gets too difficult, just wanting to space out. When people are caught in unwholesomeness with space, they don't bother to wash dishes or take care of themselves, it's too much effort. When this dullness is purified, there is a sense of openness and spaciousness, as if the mind is willing to be present no matter what is there. And there is a sense of warmth toward whatever is present. That's space. Now imagine that also in front of you is the Vajra family. In uninvolved states, this quality is surveys and reflects the environment with sharp accuracy. There is a fear of not having the situation covered, and if there are any surprises, the reaction is anger or denial, like frozen water. Gotta have it all. Vajra type is intellectual and conceptual, likes to have systems for everything. In more neurotic times, complex systems of how everything works are evolved. The problem is that they have little relationship to the situation at hand. When this angry, controlling intellect is transformed into the original state, it becomes mirror-like wisdom. So that rather than trying to make sure you see everything, everything that arises is another facet. It is associated with the element water, blue or white. These are like dakinis. A dakini is a dakini because it's an energy. So there's the energy of the space you're in. Now in front of you there's the energy of the watery quality of what you're reflecting. Then you imagine yourself turning clockwise and seeing the next dakini, who is yellow, gold. She belongs to the jewel family. She's the element earth. She's yellow, like autumn. When she is not very evolved, the energy insists on filling every corner because there is never enough. There is always a sense of needing more. A tendency to be greedy and domineering. A tendency to want to be the center of things. needing to accumulate food and possessions, a sense of pride, needing to think that people feel they're important. When it's purified into wisdom, it becomes all enriching wisdom. Without the attachment of the ego, the expansiveness of Ratna enriches every situation. Wonderful things are created and the surroundings are enriched. And imagine yourself turning one more time and you're looking at the Padma family, the lotus family, the bright red hot tomato dakini involved with seduction. So not the acquisition of material things, but an interest in relationships, but wanting to accumulate desirable feelings. Wanting to draw people in, wanting to possess them. The mental pattern involves a dilettantish, scattered kind of activity. Projects are started and then dropped when the superficial glamour wears off. Pleasure is very important. Pain is the same as rejection or abandonment, and so as soon as there's a chance of pain, the Padma family being is out of there. The wisdom which emerges when this energy is freed from the ego's hold is called discriminating awareness. Consciousness is able to discriminate when they're no longer pushed around by like and dislike. Things can be seen with profound cognition. Aesthetics become great art, enlightened, and great art can be created with this energy because it can see the relationships between all things. It can see the one taste of all existence. Associated with the West in spring, with fire. And one more turn, and there's the karma family action. It's always working at something, always going somewhere. And so this dakini is in profile. She's not looking straight at you. She's too busy. She's on her way. This is the speed of the air element. It's very aggressive and impulsive. With this dakini, when there is, and this energy, when there is a negative feeling, it's a tendency toward paranoia, a fear of losing track of all the plots that are going on. So they're usually organizing everyone and everything, making sure things are under control. When it is freed from the fear and becomes purified, it becomes the wisdom that accomplishes everything. And there is a clear understanding that everything is the activity of the Buddha. Enlightened activity is taking place. So therefore, there is a great benefit to many beings. Associated with winter, the north, envy. So in the center there is the space dakini, either wide open and spacious or spaced out or cloudy. Feel that. Feel what space you're in. Now look ahead at the water dakini. It's the Vajra family, the diamond family. They're wanting to see everything, wanting to know how things connect. If something doesn't fit into your idea of how things connect, how do you react? Is there a willingness to open to what is outside of your understanding? Is the dakini that reflects mirror-like wisdom reflects all wisdom. And the next one was the golden Dakini of the Jewel family, who in her neurotic state needs to accumulate, needs to be important. In her non-neurotic state, wherever she goes, gifts arise. The next one was the seductive Dakini. In her neurotic state, always wanting to fall in love, but never wanting to work with the result. Always looking for the big splash, the big desire. Really afraid of dislike or commitment. Like fire. And when it is purified, it is the discriminating wisdom that knows the one taste of all. And then the air Dakini. Wrathful and paranoid, having to organize everything, not being comfortable, not knowing things, involved in plots, trying to get the story. Can tend to be very sharp and impulsive and aggressive. Or when purified, can be the wisdom of the activity of awakening. Knowing how to move with all action, all activity, so that it blossoms into the most wholesome. Now looking at each of those Dakinis, imagine that one of the four has a gift for you. Imagine, maybe it's the fifth one, maybe it's the one that you're sitting in the lap of in space. The space Dakini. The water Dakini. The earth Dakini. Fire Dakini, the air Dakini, one of them has a gift for you. That's fine. So you take that gift and you work with it. So in order to start any teaching that is a traditional teaching, you do a mandala offering. Mandala offering is a Northern School production. And a mandala offering is basically saying, now I am arising in space with these four energies around me. I also see that all that is around me is also arising in space with these four energies around me. This is the aspiration to come to compassion and wisdom arising in space using these four powers in order to manifest. I would like to take all of these four powers and with both the passive and the active forces, the sun and the moon, I would like to make an offering to all that exists in order to come to a greater realization. I offer myself and all the universe symbolically with these activities so that I may receive back a gift of greater understanding. It's called a mandala offering. Is that good? So we're going to do a mandala offering because it's part of that other little thing you got that sort of is this shape, which is the Manjushri prayer that you do if you want to receive teaching. You should do this every morning. And I'm going to just put you through awful here. We're going to do it in Tibetan and in English. And you're going to have to just come along at the same clip I'm going. So just, you know how to do this. You all, some of you have been through this with me before. And you have to move your lips anyway, because I'll be watching. I'm watching. And if I don't see you doing it, you know what I do? Everybody here knows this is true. And if you haven't been here before, you'll find out. I take my teeth out and smile at you. So let this be a warning to you. Oh, you don't have one? Yes. See, my threat worked. How many? Three? Everybody else got one? Do you have one, Otto?
No. Yeah, no, I do.
Have you all got one? Anyone don't have one? Doesn't have one?
All got one.
Okay. Lama dangam pujat sanjam payam racha shalom gangilodo tibni tintani tariyat namda krapsame jine dongkun jishin jishir niki tokale kwamsam gang dak sipkai samra marek muntam dugel jisir way. We're on 2A now. Duso kun la buchik tase yan lak to chu yan den sum Duta cheto pneumoni long leki cheto toze chin. Marek munsel dugel nyuku jinye chose reltinam. Dune dashik sachu tarson yon ten lusa jase tu boku. Chuta chudan junye tente daglo munsel jampayan. La do. You sounded like a bunch of Tibetans. You were just so good. And now we go back to the English at the beginning. You'll be relieved to know. Obeisance to my guru and protector Manjushri, whose intelligence shines forth as the sun, unclouded by delusion or traces of ignorance, who holds to his heart a scriptural text symbolic of seeing all things as they are, who teaches in 60 ways with the loving compassion of a father for his only son. All creatures caught in the prison of samsara, confused in the darkness of their ignorance, overwhelmed by his suffering. You whose dragon thunder-like proclamation of the Dharma arouses us from the stupor of our delusions and frees us from the iron chains of our karma. Who wields the sword of wisdom, hewing down suffering wherever its sprouts appear, clearing away the darkness of ignorance. You whose princely body is adorned with the 112 marks of the Buddha, who has completed the stages, achieving the highest perfection of a bodhisattva, who has been pure from the beginning. I bow down to you, Manjushri. And now we're going to do the mantra. The mantra is very interesting. It's Om Arapachanadi. For Om is the sound that means coming into creation. Ah is that syllable in the middle. So it's like blue-white syllable in the middle of your heart. Ra, pa, cha, na, around it. And then D is like a spark of light. So this is the mantra of Manjushri. It's the light shining on. The light of your own intelligence shining on the elements that allow anything to come into manifestation. You got that? Should I run through it again? And as D is like lightning, like a flash of light. D, 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 D. It's like a light, a spark. Om is just a syllable meaning coming into being. So coming into being, Om. And Ah in the center, like green Tara in that picture. Where's the picture now? Keep passing it around. Green Tara in the center. And then Ra, Pa, Cha, Na, around, four spokes around that Ah sound. Om, Ah, nice blue Ah. Ra, Pa, Cha, Na, spark. So whatever manifestation is coming into existence, over and over again, Om, Ah, Ra, Pa, Cha, Na, Di. Whatever is present, lit up by consciousness, understood, seen as it is, not confused. Not a bad idea. Okay? Om, what's the matter? Om, okay. Om, Ah, Rabajanadi. Om, Ah, Rabajanadi. Om, Ah, Rabajanadi. Om, Ah, Rabajanadi. Then the other thing you do, and this is going to give you the facility to be a used car salesman, you say 100 D syllables on one breath. So you take a deep breath. Om Maravatana. That was more than 100. Some of you are going to have to maybe not be a used car salesman this week. Have to wait and get another career. Okay. Strangely enough, this works. Makes your mind brighter. Then sit in Kyoki Kenrabo Suchi Daglo di Momon Borapsale Kadante Sholodo Popayi Lodo Popanawa Salduso. So you've got a little insert there. Just as two pages, just lift them off to the side for a moment because you're going to use them right now. But this is with the brilliance of your wisdom, O compassionate one. Illuminate the darkness enclosing my mind. Can you see that? Enlighten my on page 2B,
yeah.
The bottom,
mm-hmm.
2B.
Mm-hmm.
Say it in with the brilliance of your wisdom, O compassionate one. Illuminate the darkness enclosing my mind. Enlighten my intelligence and wisdom so that I may gain insight into Buddha's words and the texts that explain them. And do it again in Tibetan. Say den kyoki ken rabo se ji daglo ti momun parap san ne karan ten sho chu mo to pa yi lo ro po pa nang wa sa du so. With the brilliance of your wisdom, O compassionate one, illuminate the darkness enclosing my mind. Enlighten my intelligence and wisdom so I may gain wisdom tied into the Buddha's words and the texts that explain them. Say den kyoki ken rabo se ji Daglo ti momum parapsane Kadan tencho shuno topayi Lodopo panangwa saviso. With the brilliance of your wisdom, O compassionate one, illuminate the darkness enclosing my mind. Enlighten my intelligence and wisdom so I may gain insight into Buddha's words and the texts that explain them. So now you're going to the insert. This is how you're going to gain insight. Imagine that the whole of your inside and outside of your body is actually spacious, like that ah space. And this is the hollow. This is the mantra for becoming aware of the hollowness, the spaciousness, inside and outside. Om Sabhava Shuddha Sarvadharma. Just feel the spaciousness of where you are. And then imagine that that ah sound starts to vibrate in your heart. Run out of breath, just imagine the ah sound is still sounding from that ah syllable in your heart. That star in the blue sphere inside your heart, which is the nature of your true mind. Just listen to the ah. You can think of it like A-W-E. And just focus on the awe in your heart and imagine that sound is coming from there. Starts to wander too much, you go back again. Imagine that sound is still coming from the ah syllable in your heart. Terry, stop. Of your peacefulness in your heart. Then it says, Om Akaramukam Savadamanamadi Anyutai Hunavati Twat. Sorry. Om Ah is first because of the primordial non arising of all events from the very no beginning. Rang ni la sa chi ten du la la da ten pen ka ta li ka po ya po dan ka li ma po yong ko dan ten ning nong po ya ko la mek na nang rim du du da. I am the deity. On my tongue from a moon. On it from palm a white lotus. Round its center white alley clockwise. Then red kali counterclockwise. Then the heart of dependent arising blue and clockwise. I recite them in snake-like succession with the innermost purpose. So I am the deity, meaning that once you have done that awe sound in your heart, you pretend that you can actually feel the Buddha wisdom of your true mind. You don't like Buddha, you don't use that word. The true nature of your own mind moving out, whether you can or not. As one of my teachers used to say, if you start with a plastic Jesus, start with a plastic Jesus. You keep paying reverence, and then that you are like a rainbow-bodied being. Because you are. You just haven't noticed it. Okay? So you're just pretending that what is really true is what you're noticing. That's what you're doing. You're pretending that you're not pretending it isn't true. I am the deity. Imagine yourself as a rainbow energy. On my tongue, right on the tip of your tongue, there's an ah sound, ah, and then a moon disc, a flat, full moon pillow. Little one, not too big. You only got a small one. Keep it small. Arises. And then, bum sound, a white, little tiny white lotus arises. Bum. Right on the edge of your tongue. In the center is the white letters of the vowels of the alphabet of Sanskrit alphabet. And they're running in a clockwise direction and they're giving off white light. Next is a circle of red consonants of the Sanskrit alphabet going counterclockwise, giving off a red light. Then a mantra going clockwise, giving off a blue light. Now, if you turn that page over, well, I'll be darned. There it is. So the first one is the vowels. So we're going to say them and imagine on the lotus, there's the moon disc, there's the lotus, and now in the center there's going to be this little circle going clockwise. This is kind of like rubbing your belly and patting your head at the same time. You're going to have three circles and they're not all going to be moving in the same direction. So you just imagine it. Om a a e e u u re re le le e e o o om a so ha. This is white light. Om a a e e u u re re le le e e o o om a so ha. Om a a e e u u re re le le e e o o om a so ha. Now the red light, these syllables are in groups of five, more or less. Om ka 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 nga, cha 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 nga, ta 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 nga, ta 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 nga, pa 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 ma, ya ra la wa sa sha sa ha ksha so. Red light going counterclockwise. Om ka 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 nga, cha 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 nga, ta 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 nya, ta 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 na, pa 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 ma, ya ra la wa sa sha sa ha ksha so ha. Om ka 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 nga, cha 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 na, ta ta da da na, ta ta da da na, pa 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 ma, ya ra la va sa cha sa ha cha so ha. Now blue light, clockwise. Om yidama he tu prabhava hitin te shan ta 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 hi wa da ta. Tishan chayo nirodho evam vadi maha shamana iswaha. Om of dharmas which originate from causes, the Tathagata has proclaimed the causes and their cessation, the truth-telling great ascetic soha. Om yidama he tu prabhava hatun te shan tatakata hivadata te kanjayo nirodha vamari mahashramana iswaha. So that's it. That's three times. We did once in English. Okay, now light, oh sorry, sabonga teng o zerji jiten da da ma ta ki sungak jin tu ngak sung da punso jazi rin jin da ta shi ta pya nam par kuk tim pa ten in ka le da. You can go to the next page. A le pa ma da da nam ga ma che tim bi je gyu de en ka ma du sur ju che tim do je rang jing gyu. Light from the speech and mantra garlands summons inspiring powers of speech, worldly and supramundane. In the form of the three mantras, the seven perfect royal treasures, and the eight lucky signs, when these dissolve the heart of dependent and arising, Kali, Ali, lotus and moon seed dissolve into a bindu, clear but slightly white on top and reddish on the bottom. This melts into nectar which permeates your tongue. Swallow. Your speech is watery. So now light from those garlands. Those three circles. Now imagine those lights, three lights, white, red, and blue lights just going out. to all the universe and whatever ordinary, relative, and absolute truths there can be, it gathers them. It's like a gleaning process and brings them back to your tongue in the form of Om Ahum. Just imagine that all these blessings come into your tongue, into that lotus and moon disc on your tongue. And as they come onto the tongue, the lotus, the moon disc, and the three mantras all dissolve. And a little seed forms. It's like a little bubble. It's almost clear, but the slightest bit of white on the top, slightest bit of red on the bottom. Feel it there, like a little drop of moisture. Imagine it just melts. And there's a sweet taste on your tongue. And swallow. Okay. And now, we're at the mandal offering. You can see that we're going to race through this pretty fast once I've explained it to you. Next time we're not going to take nearly as much time with that. Right? Yes. So, you start mandala offering by putting a few grains of rice on and then polishing it. By imagining you're dissolving all the old patterns. Om Ahum, Om Ahum, Om Ahum. Dump. Now you're going to develop new patterns. Namo Gurube, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Sanghaya. Namo Gurube, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Sanghaya. Namo Gurube, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Sanghaya. I've already taught you about clockwise and counterclockwise, so you know all about that. Of course. We won't even go into it. Creation and dissolution. So you say, Sashi Poku, Junjo me totram, the ground is purified with scented water and strewn with flowers. That means to say it has been purified by your aspiration and you got energy to do something new. That's the first line, isn't it? Sashi pochu, junjo me totram. Isn't that the first line there? Oh, you closed your book. Open it up again. What page are we on? Three? Is it three?
3A.
3A? See, it says, the ground is purified with scented water and strewn with flour. Have I got the right translation?
Yes.
Yeah.
Did you find it? 3A? It's after that little Ali Kali alphabet thing we did. Everybody got it? So, Sashi Pochu Jun Shug Me Tokram. The ground is purified with scented water and strewn with flowers. That's what we just did. Like purifying it was dissolution of Om Ahum and scented with and strewn with flowers is the aspiration that you're doing Namo Buddha Dharma Sangha, right? It is adorned with Meru, king of mountains, the four quarters of the universe. We already did that. Earth, you know, I've already explained that, right? Earth, water, fire, air. Mount Meru is whatever is arising at the moment in space. And the four quarters of the universe, you always start towards you, that's the east towards you, because you're always entering at the beginning of whatever it is, so it's considered sunrise. Always, whatever is facing you is always considered the east. The four quarters of the universe, I've got jewels, gemstones mixed in with this, rice, and different wildflower seeds. The sun and the moon. Thinking of this as the awakened state and as representative of what's going to be here and as representative of the entire universe, offer. So I would have when I do this at home every day, I have three chants, I say, not just this one. So by that time I've used up all this rice, but at the moment. So this is going to be my crowning. I have this nice little opal that I use for the crown of it. By virtue of this offering, may all beings here and now attain the happiness of the pure land. Alalahu. And that's mandala offering. Okay? Sashi pochu jung shuk me tov tram. We rabbling sini de jen padi. Here's the nice mudra you get to do. Your left hand and your right thumb. Like this, as if you were going to do this, you know? Just as if you were going to do that. Your left thumb, your right thumb and your left little finger. Right. Now, bring your left thumb towards your right thumb. Right? And then bring your little finger on your right hand towards your thumb. Right? So you've got your thumbs and your little fingers together. Now turn your hands so your palms are facing you. Excellent. So that's two of the four quarters there. Put your ring fingers back to back. Your ring fingers. I know, but some people get married. Your ring fingers back to back. Yeah, you have to actually stick your elbows out more. Yeah, so your hands turn, your knuckles turn toward each other. Your knuckles turn toward each other. Oh, I see you had your little fingers on the wrong. Help her there, Otto. Start again. Right thumb, left little finger. Got that? Yeah. That'll do fine. Left thumb, right little finger. Excellent. Turn thumbs, yeah. Turn your hands so your palms are up. So you see your little fingers and your thumbs? That makes one element, and that makes another element. See? One element and the other element. They're sticking up. They make little mountains. See? Mm. Little mountains. Mm. That's one mountain, two mountain. Now we need Mount Meru in the middle. So you stick your ring fingers back to back. Excellent. Only move your elbows out more, maybe. Or, I don't know.
I think I've got arthritis or something. I don't think
you can't do it? Okay. That's okay. Your ring fingers back to back. And now take your next finger and on your right hand, and your index finger on your left hand should hook it, like that. You see, it's so hard when you're watching me. I got to turn around. Yeah, you want to? Yeah? Got that? No, index finger hooks this. And index finger hooks this. There. Index finger hooks that. And index finger. Right. I'll say, you want to go back and show them? Go back to the back. She's afraid to let go now. And so it looks like this.
Oh, you're right.
You got it. See? Go closer so they can see. Yeah, see, you got to be facing the same way as they are. They can't see. That's a mandala offering. See, there's Mount Meru in the center. And the four quarters of the universe. See them there? 1, 2, 3, 4. Anybody? Everybody got it?
Thank you very much.
You got it. Good for you. You're all a bunch of excellent women. Good for you. You're a wonderful Tibetan. I bet you never thought you'd be a Tibetan so easily. Does that stop? I understand that pennywort. If you eat it for two leaves for about 6 weeks, you'll notice a difference.
In flexibility.
In arthritis.
Yeah.
I just watched, I was talking to a doctor in Australia about it. I was just in Australia. Can I tell you?
What are you doing for 2 weeks?
Excuse me. So? Everybody got that? So there's the mandala offering. So when you do that chanting, you usually say that. Sashi po tu jun chu me ta tra mi ra ling jin in ya jen pa di. Sanje jin la mi de o yi. Bokun dropun nam da jing la cho pa shun. Or in English, the ground is purified with scented water and strewn with flowers. You usually also have a couple of grains of rice in your left hand when you do this. So they've got a couple of grains of rice in your left palm. It is adorned with Mount Meru, there it is in the center, four quarters of the universe, the sun and the moon. Thinking of this as the Blessed Buddha field, this is the field of Blessed Buddha nature. I offer it. By virtue of this offering, may all beings here and now attain the happiness of the Pure Land. Alala. There you go. Is that good? So that's all the technical stuff. I think it's nice to know, you know, some of this ritual, have a little bit of an understanding of what it's about. And if you are interested at all in using the energies, if you're interested in insight only, you won't be the least bit interested in this of the four elements and space. But if you're interested in working with emotions, in understanding relationship, then you want to know what each of those elements are, in because they are the whole range of our emotional body. They're all the communicators. Speech. That is the speech body. How the five elements are used. And in the Tibetan tradition, that is where all of these deities come from. They all represent some aspect of the purification of states of mind, which is just combinations of the five elements. So every one of these deities are showing a different way of using the mind, body, and emotions to come to clarity and not get caught in suffering. That's what they're about. That's what they're about. Did you find that interesting, that exercise with the five dakinis? Did you, everyone get a gift? It's interesting, isn't it? You didn't get a gift? Sure. Sometimes no gift is the gift, too. I had that happen. Okay. We're finished with that. You don't get that. So, now we're going to this introduction. The Xerox copy that I gave you, the big thick one. We're going to do the introduction to this book, so that you have some basis for understanding the various sutras when we get to it. So like I said, this is going to be a study that goes on all winter, and maybe for a year. I wouldn't mind doing this for 3 years, but it's up to you. We're just doing it Thursday night, so it's a lot to cover. So the Majjhima Nikaya as a collection. The Majjhima Nikaya is the second collection of the Buddha's discourses found in the Sutta Pitaka of the Pali Canon. Anything I say you don't understand, ask. You all know what Sutta Pitaka is. You all know what Pali Canon is. Okay, what? Do I hear a question?
Sutta Pitaka?
It means the heard basket, the basket of hearings. There are three baskets of teaching in Buddhism, and they're called baskets because they actually were carried around in baskets. And there were three collections. There was a whole bunch of baskets that held all of the teaching that everybody who came to the conference agreed that the Buddha had actually said, when he just was wandering around talking to people here or there. So these are a lot of them are addressed to bhikkhus, but they're also to monks, but they're also addressed to all kinds of people. This is one of the collections of sayings of the Buddha that was in the baskets that had his ordinary talks, like this talk is going on right now, or a talk he would have had with somebody in a marketplace somewhere, or a talk, somebody coming up and asking him, you know, I think in this one there's this guy who comes up and starts calling him names, and how the Buddha reacted to that, you know. Those kind of talks are in the Sutta Pitaka. This other basket is called the Vinaya Pitaka, which means the rules. And that consists of all the rules that monks and nuns have to keep in order to be considered good members of the ordained the clergy. And the rules are accompanied by the story of why the rule came into being. So, for example, the rule about monks having to wear robes that were made of patches came because there were all these homeless people were following the Buddha around wherever he went. And so they started looking really scruffy after a while, and then they would get cold after a while. So they would go through a village, and then what the clothes that people had on their clotheslines wouldn't be there when they left, you know. And so after a short while, the reputation preceded them, and so people would come out of their village and say, "We're really glad you're here. Do you mind camping out of town? You know, and we'll bring food to you." So he started saying, "Well, why is this happening?" And they said, "Well, because last time you were here, you know, we lost all our clothes. And the time before, you know, that village doesn't have any sheets left. And, you know, over there." And so then the Buddha called all the monks together and nuns together and said, "Okay, bhikkhu is the word that's translated as monk, but it actually means homeless one. Like homeless people on the streets here. Beggar means beggar." So he said, "You beggars, come here, I've got to talk to you." He says, "You're not allowed to take any cloth to make a robe from unless it's from a charnel ground, from a graveyard. The only cloth you can take is either from a garbage dump or a graveyard. And what you have to do in order so it's not contaminated is you have to boil it for so long, and then you have to dye it so it doesn't have any blood stains on it, you know, with the jackfruit, which is a very dark dye. And then you sew all the pieces together. And that's the kind of robes you can wear. That is, you have to make robes out of something that nobody else wants." So that's how the origin. You've seen Buddhist monks who have these robes with these seams all over them. That's why it remains the tradition. It's one of the rules, that you have to make your robes out of rags.
Both traditions of Tibetan and...
Yeah, and Tibetan robes also, you know, if you look at them, even if it's one piece, they cut it in half and then sew it together. Just to remind you, you know, that you're living, you're not living for classy things. You're not stealing either from others. Like everything you desire should not cause difficulty for anyone else. That's sort of a basic rule. So all those stories and all those rules are in the Vinaya Pitaka. And then the third of the three baskets is called the Abhidhamma Pitaka, which means it's Namgyal Rinpoche, my beloved teacher Namgyal Rinpoche, calls it the physics of Buddhism, or the higher philosophy of Buddhism. And the Abhidhamma looks at a mind-body conglomerate in terms of being citta or mind, cetasika, mental states, which we could call speech, and rupa or formation. So it's based on a trilogy, body, speech, and mind. And the Sutta Pitaka, which this is a member of, talks much more about a mind-body conglomerate being made of the five elements, the five aggregates, which we talked about here tonight, the five elements, five aggregates. Okay? That's a rough sketch. Is that all right? That's what the Sutta Pitaka is. And the Pali canon, Pali was the language that the Buddha spoke. And it was not a written language, so Sanskrit was the scholarly language, and Pali was a more common language. They're very similar in a lot of cases.
The Abhidhamma, it can be purchased in a book form too, can it not?
Yeah, there's seven books in the Abhidhamma. There are actually 44. Are there 44 books in the Tipitaka? Like, this is one part of the Tipitaka. This is usually printed in three volumes. In this case, it's all in one volume. There are 44 books altogether in the whole Tipitaka. Seven of them are the Abhidhamma. And the greatest bulk of them are the Abhidhamma Sutta. The greatest volume of them are the Sutta Pitaka. This, what this belongs to.
So that's all one, or there's more that belongs to this,
yeah? Oh yeah, this is just one. The Sutta Pitaka is most, has more volumes. It's the biggest bunch of baskets. Okay. There are 44 Bibles in Buddhism.
About that size?
More or less. Yeah. Some of them are quite slim, yeah. And some of them are easily this size. Okay. This is one collection called the Middle Length Sayings. There is the Long Sayings, which is called the Digha Nikaya. Yeah. This is the Majjhima, Middle Nikaya collection of sayings. Body, Kaya. Any other questions? I hope this is interesting to you. Mm-hmm. We get the background down, then when we go through the text, you won't have so many questions. All right? Its title means literally the middle collection, and is so called because the suttas it contains are generally of middle length compared with the longer suttas of the Digha Nikaya. Now see, in Pali you say sutta, in Sanskrit you say sutra. So you heard the word sutra probably. But Pali is like a southern accent almost, you know. Y'all come and see me sometime. I'll just have a sutta for you. It's not that sutra. And the shorter suttas making up the two major collections that follow it, the Samyutta Nikaya and the Anguttara Nikaya. There, now you know everything. The Majjhima Nikaya consists of 152 suttas. These are divided into three parts called sets of 50. Though the last set actually contains 52 suttas. Within each part, the suttas are further grouped into chapters or divisions of 10 suttas each. The next to the last division containing 12 suttas. The names assigned to these divisions are often derived solely from the titles of their opening sutta, or in some cases pairs of suttas, and thus are scarcely indicative of the material found within the divisions themselves. A partial exception is the middle 50, where the division titles usually refer to the principal type of interlocutor or key figure in each of the suttas they contain. Even then, the connection between the title and the contents is sometimes tenuous, to say the least. The entire system of classification appears to have been devised more for the purpose of convenience than because of any essential homogeneity of subject matter in the suttas composed under a single division. There is also no particular pedagogical sequence in the suttas. No unfolding development of thought. Thus, while different suttas illuminate each other, and one will fill in ideas merely suggested by another, virtually any sutta may be taken up for individual study, and will be found comprehensible on its own. Of course, the study of the entire compilation will naturally yield the richest harvest of understanding. If the Majjhima Nikaya were to be characterized by a single phrase to distinguish it from among the other books of the Pali Canon, this might be done by describing it as the collection that combines the richest variety of contextual settings with the deepest and most comprehensive assortment of teachings. If you really would like to have one volume that will give you the greatest understanding of Dharma as taught by Shakyamuni Buddha, this is it. This is the best one for you to study, to really understand what he was talking about. There isn't, I don't think you really value, can appreciate or understand or work with the teaching in the Abhidhamma until you've read something like this. Yes?
Paragraphs just a bit. How does the path, both the path of purification and the back, how does that fit into this? Is that,
Buddha Ghosa.
Sorry? You know, the path of purification.
I know exactly what you're talking about, yeah? How does it fit into this system?
Yeah.
Buddha Ghosa was the author of the Path of Purification, and he came some time after the time of the Buddha. And he wrote the Path of Purification based on 7 characteristics of developing the mind training. And those 7 characteristics he basically picked, actually, from this book. So he based that on the Buddha's teaching.
So actually, you could look at that as a teaching manual of sorts based on that, as a generalization, I guess.
Well, he also put down a lot of things that were understood at the time of the Buddha, because the Buddha was a Hindu. Mm-hmm. And the Buddha did not himself, he was raised in a Hindu culture, and he did not himself invent all the meditations. In fact, only 2 of them, of the 40 classical meditations, only 2 of them were ones that he himself put forward. I mean, basically, he took from the teachers of his time and continued working with meditation system that has been going for a very long time. The teaching on the 5 elements is universal. If you look in Christianity, you have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You know, in church windows, in cathedrals, got in the corners, and they are the 4 elements. I mean, that's what they are, aren't they? You know that. You know that?
Don't.
You don't know that?
They teach us that.
In the tarot, you see the 4. In the wheel of fortune card, and in the world card.
In the medicine wheel too.
The medicine wheel, absolutely. Medicine wheel is most beautifully the 4. The 4 directions. Any basic. If you look at any tradition, you will find that you always have that center point arising in the 4 directions, how you're going to work it. Sometimes you call it the 4 seasons, often in the medicine wheel, but it's also usually related to an element at the same time. Yes?
Which were the 2 meditations that this Buddha came up with?
Meditation Anapanasati and meditation on the parts of the body.
Not all Indian traditions, the larynx has to find the earthmost, and the earthmost has to find the skymost. The skymost has to have the firemost, and they have to go together and make it both mean. Mm-hmm. I forgot my last step.
Airmost?
Yeah. And the boys are taught, the little girls are taught, the young people. The airmost has to find the firemost, the firemost, and they have to go together and find the earthmost. And they have to go together and find the other most.
Lovely. That's
so
lovely.
It seems to run through humanity.
Yeah, I have looked at a lot of cultures and have seen prayers with those 5 elements in every culture that I've looked at. And certainly in your own being. I mean, if you actually will work a little bit with that exercise with the four dakinis around and you're supervising the space, I think you'll find it very rich, yes.
So if we use the analogy of the wheel or the mandala, that which holds all of the spokes together, that is the core of
No, I mean, it is true that space is the container and the separator of all of them, but where one element appears, all of them appear. They can't think of one as being more primal. We tend to look for that a lot. I think a lot of our sense of what is right gets in the way because we want an answer or a place to focus. And it is absolutely true that a wheel can't turn unless there's nothing turning in the center. It is absolutely true that it is the still point in the center that the wheel turns around. It's absolutely true. And it's absolutely true that the nothing is there in the middle of the turning.
I was just thinking of the multeity and unity notion that comes up sometimes in some philosophies or in some poetry.
Yeah.
And the different spokes would not, in those cases more in Western thinking I suppose, perhaps have a consciousness of how it all ties together. But it is all together.
It is all together, yes. And all dissolving simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And that's really hard. Mm-hmm. That's really hard. Mm-hmm. And that is really hard. I mean, that's, we love our answers. Yeah. Maybe I misunderstood you.
No,
did I?
Didn't.
Yeah? Okay.
I think it is partly the difference between Western thinking and Eastern thinking.
It is a big difference, and also a difference between a society that has for a long time had the sense that there's something you have to watch out for. You know, the Dakini who is the heir Dakini is also defensive. She's involved with defense. Wrathfulness and defense. Yeah. The Dakini who is the water Dakini is also the Dakini of sleep. The Dakini who is the earth Dakini is also the Dakini of hunger and eating. And the Dakini of the fire, who is that fiery desire energy, the seductive Dakini, is also the Dakini of sex. And in the Buddha, who was a very good Hindu, said, you're born with four demons on your shoulders. Sleep, food, sex, and defense, or protection. And those four are always there. Four are always there. Always there. These four driving energies, always there, four desires, they are the four elements. And you arise in space, and there are these four. And how do you transmute them? How do you transmute them? It's a really interesting question. My Native American teacher told me that Europeans are the fire race, desire. They always want the next thing. They love to fall in love. They're always going for the next thing. The better thing. They hate pain. They're always looking for the good. They're afraid of being punished. So they don't look at what they're consuming because they're reaching for the next thing to consume. And in a way, this is what I'm saying when I'm saying that in our culture, because we're so intent on getting the next thing to fall in love with. I mean, look at our advertising, I mean, you know. Yeah. How much of your day do you look at advertising, whether you watch TV or not? Brand names everywhere. You can't see a pair of shoes without a brand name on it. It's true? Mm-hmm. Yeah, our culture is like just everywhere. The Dakini of, you know, grab a new one, get a bigger one. I mean, fall in love with this, fall in love with this, fall. There's a certain truth in it. I mean, she's pretty powerful in our society, isn't she, that red hot tomato? She just draws us on. Those breasts look pretty good. Don't they? Don't they? Come on.
Seems to be an element there too in the wanting. At first it seems pretty good to be wanting to get a car or a person, and you want something that you see in them. You want it, or it, and you want to possess it, you want to own it. And then when you get hold of it, you find it isn't there.
That's right. Yeah, it's always going into the future. Always pursuit. That's right. Always going into the future. And that's like fire, you know, when it hits treetops. I've seen that.
Yeah.
Seen that? My God. Just runs on the treetops. Just going to the next.
You're wondering.
It's very powerful.
I'm wondering if desire is always such a bad thing. Whether
I'm actually working with the Majjhima Nikaya, Maura, so okay. I'm not going in there.
Okay.
I've already been sidetracked.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, just okay. Getting right back to work here.
Okay. Okay.
Yes.
I'm so sorry, I must go.
Please. Thank you for coming. Thank you for coming. You're welcome to keep all of it except the little, which you leave. And you, if you want a copy of it, you can talk to Kathy and get a copy. But all the rest of it, you're welcome to keep. Thank you. How are we doing? 9:00? Got another 15 minutes?
Sure.
Those are also, by the way, those four demons are sometimes called the four poisons or four maras. You can relate them to some degree. The four ways they get caught in clinging to a sense of self, trying to make a sense of self, as if there were some permanence that you could make. Four ways that you get caught. And why human birth is considered to be precious is because you get enough relief from those four that you can get an answer to the question you ask when you're caught by those four. There's enough suffering to ask a question and enough relief from suffering to get an answer. So human birth is considered to be very valuable. Like the Digha Nikaya, the Majjhima is replete with drama and narrative, while lacking much of its predecessor's tendency toward imaginative embellishment and profusion of legend. Makes me just want to turn to the Digha Nikaya. How about you? Like the Samyutta, it contains some of the profoundest discourses in the canon, disclosing the Buddha's radical insights into the nature of existence. And like the Anguttara, it covers a wide range of topics of practical applicability. In contrast to those two Nikayas, however, the Majjhima sets forth this material not in the form of short self-contained utterances, but in the context of a fascinating procession of scenarios that exhibit the Buddha's resplendence of wisdom, his skill in adapting his teachings to the needs and proclivities of his interlocutors, his wit and gentle humor, his majestic sublimity, excuse me, and his compassionate humanity. Naturally, the greatest number of discourses in the Majjhima are addressed to bhikkhus, monks, since they lived in closest proximity to the Master and had followed him into homelessness to take upon themselves his complete course of training. But in the Majjhima, we do not meet the Buddha only in his role as head of the order. Repeatedly, we see him engaged in living dialogue with people from the many different strata of ancient Indian society, with kings and princes, with Brahmins and ascetics, with simple villagers and erudite philosophers, with earnest seekers and vain disputants. It is perhaps in this scripture, above all others, that the Buddha emerges in the role ascribed to him in the canonical verse of homage to the Blessed One as the incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, the teacher of gods and humans. It is not the Buddha alone who appears in the Majjhima. Do you want a copy of this, Bob? Pass that to you. It is not the Buddha alone who appears in the Majjhima in the role of teacher. The work also introduces us to the accomplished disciples he produced who carried on the transmission of his teaching. Of the 152 sutras in the collection, 9 are spoken by the Venerable Sariputta, the general of the Dharma. 3 of these have become bases. I give you the keys to the kingdom, that ye shall loose what shall be loosed and bind what shall be bound. This is the kingdom, and the keys are always there, and they're always turning, and some things are loosening and some things are binding. And this is always represented as being a fiery cross where the male energy and the female energy come together. This is a fiery cross of existence. This is the beautiful spirit coming. This is the beautiful mystery of incarnation. Now, incarnation has 2 possible ways of moving. It has 3, but we'll talk about 2. Uh-huh. And one of the ways is counterclockwise. So this, if this is a fiery cross and it's moving counterclockwise, what will happen to the fire? If it's spinning this way, what will happen to the fire? No, it never goes out. Will the fire just keep going straight up? What? It'll go back. Like that. Right? That's the one that Hitler used because he was deconstructing the old order. And if the spire, I mean, he just used very old magic. This is magic. This is ritual. This is based on what your body is doing all the time. But you have to know that it's doing that before you can use it. Otherwise, it's just superstition. I can tell you all this, but until you find in yourself where those wheels are turning, it's just superstition. If you know where it is, and you know how, I give you the keys to the kingdom, that you can loose what shall be loosed and bind what should be bound, then that's the keys to the kingdom. That's a whole different story. So this is dissolution. And if the fiery cross is turning this way, what will happen? The fire will go where? Yeah. This way. Which is the other swastika. And if you look at Buddha Rupas, you usually see these 2 swastikas somewhere on them. So if you got both fires, if you got the creative cross and the passive cross, and both fires going both ways, then you get the 8-spoked wheel, which is a symbol of Buddhism. Mm-hmm. Which is the balance of energy, the balance point of energy, where energy moves equally toward dissolution and creation, where there is not more greed or more hatred. Your consciousness is not caught up. That there is an absolute balance of being able to receive and let go, to totally drink of the moment without clinging to the past or grabbing for the future. It's a middle way. So that's why that's the symbol. Okay? Does that answer you? Thank you. You see this beautiful gold light in your heart. Whose pencil is this? Spreads out through your body, pours down through your arms and legs, up through your head. Just fills your whole body like sweet honey. And it pours out through your pores in all directions. So wherever there is suffering, goes through walls and ceilings and through the earth. It goes out into endless space of body, speech, and mind based on ignorance. This light just washes it away. If there's someone you want to pray to for, just imagine them being washed in this gold light as it goes out in all directions. And you think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Thank you for your great compassion and your patience in sitting for so long.
Thank you.
Thank you.